What's up, you guys? I'm Haley.
And I'm Andrea.
And this is the 300th episode of Inhuman, a true crime podcast.
How?
I cannot believe we are on episode 300.
It's amazing. And we wouldn't be here without you guys. So let's give you guys a round of applause because you guys truly have done the damn thing.
Truly. We literally would not be here without you. Like the actual meaning of literally. But I cannot believe that we are 300 episodes, almost 3 years deep.
Yeah.
It's been a journey and we're just getting started, but you know, thank you guys for being here, for listening. If you're new and you just started listening, hey, what's up? We're happy to have you. Yeah.
And we love you already. So thanks for joining our Inhuman gang,
family,
or clan, or village, whatever you guys want to call
it. All of the above.
Yeah.
All of the above. But as a thank you and in honor of 300 episodes, I wanted to cover a big case that has been requested so many times.
Requested, yeah.
Probably one of our most requested cases. And it's a brutal one. It's a crazy one. I have like heard this before, but I honestly learned so much that I hadn't heard, even though I've like watched shows on this case and like all kinds of stuff. I feel like I learned a lot.
I know like the meat and potatoes of the case, but I don't know like all of the gory graphic details and, you know.
Yeah.
All that all great of it. Stuff.
Yeah. There's a lot. So this is in honor of all of you guys. Thank you. And let's just jump right in.
Okay.
Stephen Malat emigrated to Croatia and was working as a laborer when he married Margaret Piddleston. Together, the couple had 14 children, and their fifth child would one day become the prolific serial killer known as the Backpack Murderer.
Wow. 14 kids. I mean, and he was like in the middle?
He was the fifth.
Dang.
Ivan Milat would go on to be one of Australia's, if not the most prolific Australian serial killer. And it's a lot. So buckle in. 34-year-old Stephen Milat met Margaret Elizabeth Piddleston in church one day. And they got along quickly. But what was a little bit worrisome was that she was younger than him. Almost half his age. She was only 16 years old.
So I was afraid you were going to say that because I was like, okay, whatever. Like sometimes that just happens like that. You might be half of someone's age, but if you're a minor and you're a child, now granted, this was what year?
The 40s.
So like 40s. Okay. So kind of.
Actually at this point, like the 30s.
Yeah. So kind of like a little more acceptable.
It wasn't as frowned upon back then.
Yeah. Yeah. Like.
Yeah. So they met and Stephen was able to woo her and also was able to woo her family. And they quickly married. Their first baby was born shortly before Margaret's 17th birthday.
Wow.
And they went on to have 13 more kids over the year. Ivan Roberto Marco Milat was born on December 27th, 1944, at Crown Street Women's Hospital in Guildford, New South Wales, Australia. His family, which eventually would be made up of 10 sons and 4 daughters and his 2 parents, was described as impoverished. Impoverished. Oh my gosh, why can't I say that word?
That's a hard one. There's a lot of going on.
Impoverished. That's the best we're going to get.
Okay. Who am I to judge? Dialect, man.
It's hard. But when Ivan was young, they lived in a cottage on a rural farm about 22 miles or 36 kilometers from Sydney in Moorbank. And his father eventually started a tomato plantation, and the kids were put to work.
Mm.
The Malats were disciplinarians. They were, quote, contentious in raising, educating, and disciplining their children. And they had a more of a, like, quote unquote, traditional old school upbringing. So Stephen Malat grew up in rural Croatia before he emigrated to Australia. And in his childhood, he had to, like, hunt for food for his family. So that was kind of what was ingrained in him. And that's how he right. raised his children. So his children learned how to hunt, use firearms, and they would often, all the boys and Stephen would go out and hunt in the mornings while the daughters and Margaret were doing work around the house.
And honestly, like, that's not terrible. You know, you're instilling these good things into your children, these good traits, these good skills, yeah. You know, for survival, and the fact that they were in impoverished, mm-hmm. they had to do that, you know, and
yeah,
it can't always be just up to the one parent to go out there and do that. So I mean, as long as he's not being abusive about it, I think it's understandable.
Yeah, and there's no direct evidence of him being like physically abusive, but like he was definitely
that direction.
Yeah, I wouldn't be I mean, actually, I guess technically there is, because he would hit the children, but back then that was acceptable. You know, hit them, yeah. like spank them, like for right, discipline. Right. But there was definitely, he took it very far.
Mm, okay. Not okay.
No. The boys would often spend afternoons shooting targets in their parents' yard, and they were all very familiar with both knives and firearms, which would come into play for Ivan later.
Mm.
They were also very isolated from their neighbors, and the kids were mostly just kind of friends with their siblings instead of with other kids their age.
Right.
They all went to Catholic school, but it's said that most of them preferred the freedom of their lives at home in comparison to school. And eventually, most of the kids would drop out. The children were, you know, troublesome and would get into trouble, and they became well known to the local police, to the point where if something happened in the area, they would almost always blame one of the Malats first. Like, it would kind of just be like, oh, like, it's probably one of the Malat boys, like, getting into trouble again.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of them, so it's easy target, I guess.
Yeah, there's literally 10 of them, so.
Yeah.
The likelihood of it being one of them was pretty high.
Yeah.
Stephen Malat was also reportedly an alcoholic and had a bad temper, making their home life even worse. From the book Outback Outlaw, The Dark Legacy of Australia's Backpack Killer, Ivan Malat, by Ryan Green, which is a great book on the case. It's definitely a little bit more of like a, I don't know how to describe it other than saying like the beginning of it almost feels not sympathetic, but like they're kind of telling the story of Ivan and not the
like
victims.
An opinion piece.
More a little so bit than like, oh yeah. And okay. It does discuss some things like incest that has never been confirmed. Oh. It has been talked about in several sources, but it's never been confirmed. And I'm not going to go into it at all because it's more of just speculation. It's not.
Yeah. Sensationalizing.
True. Yeah, exactly. So this book does talk about some of that, but it is a really good book. So I'll link it in the show notes if you guys want to read it. It's like a short read. It's very interesting.
Okay.
But from that book, quote, Ivan was the one who could best take a hit before falling. He was the one who'd scowl right back at his father while he was taking his berating and his beating. Mm. So while all of this was happening, Ivan was kind of fighting back a little bit.
Okay.
And that kind of just speaks to his personality.
Yeah.
The family eventually moved out of the cottage that they grew up in to Liverpool, Australia, where Stephen began working as a wharf laborer. Their new home in Liverpool was smaller and more isolated and rural than their first home. So this played right into what Stephen wanted, you know, them kind of almost like homesteading, hunting, doing everything for themselves, being isolated. But that didn't, you know, play into the children's social lives very well.
No.
Ivan Milat specifically got into a lot of trouble in his childhood, most of which is well documented. As a kid, he was known to attack animals with machetes.
Ew, stop.
And if you know anything about true crime or serial killers at all, you know that that is an indication of a serial killer.
A killer, a psychopath, all the above. Is it like shows that you have no compassion because animals are basically like, aside from babies, they're like the most innocent thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And so he did that and got into all kinds of other trouble, so much so that he ended up serving a stint in a residential school at just 13 years old.
Wow.
So at the Boys Town Residential School, Ivan was confined to school grounds and forced to work hard labor. But he actually thrived here because this labor was less intense than what he was subjected to at home. And without the distraction of his siblings, he was able to excel in his classes and even socially, at least in his eyes, because he was very smart and did very well in academics. And he was stronger than most of his classmates, both in the labor they had to do and being able to take punishment. So this thrilled him because he kind of saw himself as like the top dog higher almost. Ivan remained at this school for 2 years, and after he was released, he went back to regular school, but he dropped out at 16 years old, as did most of the Milat children. And when he dropped out of school, that's when things started to escalate. Green says in Outback Outlaw, quote, "It was hardly surprising that the children who had grown up being told that they were nothing but criminals and would amount to nothing more did turn to crime."
Yeah.
And unfortunately, Ivan Milat's time at that residential school had only helped him learn how to steal without getting caught and how to basically become a criminal, because he learned what not to do, what would make him get caught. And and it seems like that's what happened with a lot of these schools back in the day, is like it was meant to discipline these children, but really they just kept getting into trouble, but then learned what to do because their consequences wasn't going to jail or getting arrested. It was just getting disciplined. And then they'd figure out, oh, this is why I got caught. Let me do this differently.
Right.
And when he was successful with his crimes, he just continued to escalate.
So he just started out with like petty type crimes, like stealing and
stealing, theft, robbery. Yeah. At 17 years old, Milat was caught for stealing and was sent to a juvenile detention center, but he wasn't kept there for long. His brother Boris, who is really the only Milat family member who has spoken out against Ivan after he was later caught, he believes that Ivan showed psychopathic tendencies since childhood. So he talked about Ivan harming animals and also claimed that Ivan confessed to him that when he was 17 years old, he shot a taxi driver and left the man paralyzed. So it's never been proven that this was Ivan. A man named Alan Dillon ended up being arrested and convicted of the crime and sentenced to 5 years in prison. But there are still people who believe that Dillon was completely innocent and Ivan was the one who did this. But again, Ivan has never been convicted of this crime or officially connected to it, other than what Boris has said.
Right.
At 19 years old, Ivan Milat was involved in yet another break-in that he was caught for. The next year, in 1964, 20-year-old Milat was caught for breaking and entering, and this time was sentenced to 18 months in jail. And he served that time, and when he was released, he was caught just a month later for stealing a car.
I guess so. I mean, they're letting him go every time he gets in trouble. Like, no real punishment.
Oh, and it's just going to get worse.
Oh, gosh.
This time he was sentenced to 2 years hard labor. And after that, didn't take him long to get into trouble again. In 1967, 22-year-old Malat was caught for theft again, and this time sentenced to 3 years in jail. So they're trying everything. They're increasing the prison or the amount of time he has to spend in jail. They tried hard labor. They're trying everything and nothing's working. So maybe we shouldn't release him, but, you know, that's just my opinion.
Yeah.
When Ivan was 26, he witnessed a major tragedy. He watched as his younger brother, Wally, and younger sister, Margaret, Margaret Jr., named after her mom, got into a deadly car wreck.
Oh, my God.
Wally survived, but Margaret did not. And Margaret was Ivan's favorite sibling, who he was extremely close with and, like, really cared for her. He would, like, bring her when he was away at the residential school. When he'd come back, he would, like, bring her treats and stuff. Like, they were really close. Aww. And he essentially watched her die right in front of him.
Was he in the accident as well, or was it just, like...
No, it was basically like near their home on the road, I think. And so he was like at the home, saw it happen down the road, and then ran over to them. But, you know, she couldn't be saved, unfortunately.
That's so sad.
Yeah. And losing his little sister threw Ivan into anger and grief that only escalated his crimes. In April 1971, Malat abducted two 18-year-old hitchhikers from the Liverpool railway station. He abducted them at knife point and raped one of the women.
Oh my God.
He then drove them around for some time, and they were basically in the back of his car, naked, crying.
Oh my God.
And trying to kind of like appease them and get them to stop crying, he was like, okay, I'm going to stop at a gas station to get you guys some sodas. So he pulled up to the gas station, and when he was inside, they were able to escape out of the cab. And thankfully, they weren't harmed any further. But these women, like, think about what they know now and the trauma.
Yeah. That they were the first victims, but they got away.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Malat was identified as their kidnapper, but he wasn't arrested yet.
What?
This was in part because the girls' stories kept changing slightly, and it made police suspicious, basically being like, are they just trying to pin this on Ivan Malat?
Who has a criminal record? Like, why are we questioning that? Like, and they were naked? Yeah, running to, like, safety? Like, what?
Mm-hmm. So despite his past criminal record, he was not immediately arrested as police continued to investigate. And when he caught wind that he was being investigated for this crime, he took the opportunity to flee.
Mm.
He first faked his suicide. He left his shoes at The Gap, which is a large ocean cliff in Sydney. And unfortunately, a lot of people go there to take their own lives. Mm. So he left his shoes there to make it look like that's what he had done. But instead, he fled Sydney to Queensland, then making his way to Victoria and eventually flying to New Zealand. And he remained in New Zealand undetected for the next over 2 years. He worked odd jobs and used a fake passport to travel around, and he was not caught. In 1974, Ivan's mother, Margaret, had a heart attack in Australia and was taken to the hospital. And Ivan showed up to be with her.
Oh, wow.
Thankfully, he was finally arrested when he showed up at the hospital. And he had to face the robbery, kidnapping, and rape charges from those two women.
Right.
But thanks to the Malat family lawyer, a man named John Marsden, and the time that had passed since the crime, Malat was acquitted.
Why? That is insane. He raped someone.
I know. Unfortunately, they basically weren't able they couldn't prove it because, you know, it had been so long. The women's stories kept changing again because they are traumatized and had been trying to forget this for the last almost 3 years while their rapist was on the run and they didn't know where.
And I guess they didn't do rape kits back then, right?
No, and if they did, it didn't lead anywhere.
Right.
So Ivan was not convicted on any of the charges, and he was free to go. And this is when he began working as a truck driver, which is how he worked on and off for the next 20 years.
Yeah.
In 1977, Ivan Milat unsuccessfully attempted to rape and murder two hitchhikers from Liverpool. But he was never charged in this case.
Of course he wasn't.
In 1983, 39-year-old Ivan Milat met a woman named Karen Duck. Karen was just 16 years old. Similar to his father, he wooed her and her family. And what's interesting about this relationship is that Karen met Ivan because she was pregnant by his younger cousin.
Okay.
So that's how they met. And while her boyfriend, Ivan's cousin, was off working, Ivan would go and like help her with things around the house, quote unquote, opened up to her about his life, pulled her in, and he was able to convince her to leave his cousin to be with him.
Wow.
So the two married in 1985, and she had her baby, a boy, and by all accounts, Ivan embraced being a father. They even went on to have a daughter of their own, but Ivan also began spending more and more time away from the home working, and their relationship quickly started to fall apart. There are also allegations that Ivan had affairs with several of his brother's wives.
Damn.
And many other women. And apparently when Karen confronted him about these affairs, he responded violently. Just 3 years into their marriage, Karen left Milat due to domestic violence. On February 14th, 1987, Ivan returned from work to find that Karen had left with the children and had taken everything from the house apart from Ivan's guns, which was something that she despised that he owned.
Good for her, though, because I can't imagine, what, it's the 80s. Mm-hmm. You are already in this, you know, relationship that is taboo because you were pregnant with another man's baby and then you married this other man that's his cousin. Mm-hmm. I just commend her for like being brave enough to protect herself and her children, because who knows what could have happened to them too.
Yeah. And that's not easy now, let alone back then. Yeah. Like that just didn't happen. So yeah, no, seriously, like major props to her for doing that. They were officially divorced by October 1989, but it would be another 5 years before Karen learned the truth about who her ex-husband was. So now that you know the history of Ivan Milat, let's back up a little bit to the early 1990s when several backpackers had been going missing from New South Wales, Australia. For years, hitchhiking in Australia was seen as an inexpensive and easy means to travel, as it was in most of the world in the 60s and 70s.
Right.
I mean, why wouldn't you hitch a ride with someone going in the same direction that you needed to?
Yeah.
But as more and more people were hitchhiking around the world, missing persons cases also began to ramp up. And by the late 1980s and early 1990s, those who were still hitchhiking in Australia mainly did so in pairs for safety. But unfortunately, that could not protect them all. In April 1992, 22-year-old Joanne Walters and 21-year-old Caroline Clark left King's Cross in Sydney to hitchhike around Australia. They were from England, and friends and family knew that they were planning to go all around Australia to tour around the south of the country, and they were excited for this trip. In April, they left a backpacker's hotel in Sydney to head southeast. They made it to Bully Pass, a mountain pass in New South Wales, where they reportedly asked for directions to Hume Highway, which runs between Melbourne and Sydney. And at some point, after asking for directions, they were abducted because no one ever heard from or saw them again.
Wow. That's so scary.
I know. On September 19th, 1992, two people running in the Belongolo State Forest made a gruesome discovery. Now, Belongolo is a forest in New South Wales that's almost 10,000 acres of just nature. It's pine trees, native forestry, there's trails, and it's open to the public and is a popular tourist destination for both hikers and backpackers, although it does have a very dark, sinister history, and not just because of Ivan Milat. Many deaths have been discovered in the Belongolo Forest, but that doesn't stop people from visiting.
It would stop me from visiting.
Same.
No, thank you. I don't want to run across anybody's body. No, thank you.
Yeah, and there have been people who have just gone missing from the forest or been found dead and it not necessarily be linked to, like a murder. Yeah, like it's... Yeah. There just seems to be a lot of dark stuff there. But, you know, yeah. It's also a beautiful forest, so people like to go hike through it.
Okay.
So in September 1992, these runners came across a concealed corpse and notified police. When police arrived and searched, they quickly found a second body just 100 feet or 30 meters away. It didn't take long for the bodies to be identified via dental records as the missing women from England, Caroline Clark and Joanne Walters. They had been murdered. Joanne was stabbed 14 times.
Jeez.
Four in the chest, once in the neck, and eight in the back. Five of the wounds were so deep that they cut her spine, and the ME would say that those wounds would have paralyzed her.
Oh my God. The force that you would have to do that.
I know. Caroline, on the other hand, had been shot. She had been shot 10 times in the head, execution style.
Oh my God. 10 for at times least, in the head?
Mm-hmm. And at least a couple of those bullet wounds showed that it was execution style. She also had a single stab wound in her upper back.
What in the hell? That is complete overkill.
Yeah, and you'll find out why in a second.
Okay, I don't want to find out why.
I know. So on Caroline and Joanne's bodies, there were remains to indicate that the women had been subdued and tied up to prevent them from fighting back. So around Joanne, there were the remains of a gag and neck ligature, and then there was a red cloth wrapped around Caroline's head that the bullets actually went through. So it's believed that that was like wrapped around her before she was killed. The fact that they were subdued was further verified by the absence of defense wounds on either of the victims.
So scary.
They had been buried in shallow graves about 100 feet apart. Joanne concealed with debris, such as rotting leaves, and Caroline covered by a log. The gun was determined to be a .22 caliber, and the bullets on Caroline's body also indicated something very sinister. It appeared that several of the bullets had entered her body from different directions, but the bullet casings were all found close together on the forest floor. So this told investigators that the killer had moved Caroline's body around and used her as quote-unquote target practice.
Oh my God, ew, why?
There were also six cigarette butts 14 feet away from Caroline's body, indicating that somebody had spent some time at the scene.
Hopefully they gathered those with the...
I believe they did.
Obviously he gets caught, but...
So Caroline and Joanne had been found murdered after being missing for 5 months. The investigation into their deaths began with authorities believing the killer may live nearby because of the isolated location where they were found. There was no sign of robbery. Nothing seemed to be stolen from the victims, including jewelry still on Joanne's hands. The knife that killed Joanne was found to be a Bowie knife or a knife of similar style. There was no sign of sexual assault. There were some traces of dark hair found on Joanne's shirt and hands, but basically no other beneficial physical evidence was found. And who killed them remained a mystery. Police did an extensive search of the surrounding forest. So this included 40 police officers that searched an area 500 feet wide by half a mile and a half long to search for other bodies or other evidence. But nothing was found at the time.
Right.
Over a year later, another discovery was made in a remote section of the Belongalo State Forest. On October 5th, 1993, a man was in the forest collecting firewood when he discovered bones. When police arrived on the scene, they quickly found two bodies who would later be identified as missing Australian couple Deborah Everest and James Gibson. So in December 1989, 4 years earlier, Deborah and James, who were both 19, had left Melbourne, where they were from, to travel around New South Wales. They stayed at a backpacker hostel in Sydney, and upon checkout, they were heading to Confest, which is a yearly campout festival held in the southeastern states of Australia. So they were planning to hitchhike to Albury, which was near where they would be attending Confest. And they were last seen checking out of the hotel on December 30th, 1989. The next day, James's camera was found by the side of the road in Sydney. And the person who found it actually took it home and kept it until a month later when James's empty backpack was also found in the same area. And when that was found, it was linked to James, who was at that point a missing person. So the person who found the camera came back and turned it in like, hey, I found this. But the backpack and camera brought no leads and their case went cold and they remained missing until almost four full years later when their skeletal remains were found.
It's so like creepy to me because they're all young people. So I guess that's the target. But it doesn't seem like he has any rhyme or reason to, like, who he targets. They're just young hitchhikers, just, like, easy targets.
That's exactly the only criteria in his mind for victims. Yeah. So James had stab wounds to his back and chest that were so deep that they would have punctured his heart and lungs.
Oh, my God.
But it is believed that he wasn't killed right away and that he was forced to watch Ivan, or the killer, who obviously is going to be Ivan Milat, attack Deborah. Deborah Everest had been stabbed only once in the back, but she had been brutally beaten.
Oh my God.
Her skull was fractured in two places, and her jaw was broken.
Oh my gosh.
Right?
The brutality of this fucker.
I know. And now he has stabbed, shot, and beaten people to death.
Yeah. It's like Israel Keyes, like no rhyme or reason to any of it. Like male, female, young. I mean, I'm assuming they're all young.
They are all on the younger side.
Commonality or whatever between them. But yeah, like stabbing, you know, beating, shooting.
Like there's no,
It's crazy. Psychopath.
Oh yeah. And honestly, it's surprising that they connected all of these so quickly, as you'll see in a little bit, because I mean, yes, they were found in similar area, but I feel like because all of the manners of death were different, I feel like, you know, it might have taken more time, but they did connect them pretty early on.
And the area, I mean, yes, you know, they were found in close proximity to one another. But like you said before, a lot of people are found deceased in that forest. So, yes, it's like, okay, this is a lot of people. But, you know, that wasn't too crazy either to find.
Yeah, exactly. You
know, it's like a dumping ground.
It kind of is. So Deborah and James's bodies were found over 120 kilometers or 75 miles south of where the camera and backpack were found back in December 89 and January 1990.
Right.
And this did make sense because they were traveling south to go to Albury, but Belongalo was further southwest than Albury, so whoever had killed them had kidnapped them as they were hitchhiking to make their way to the festival and then driven them further. Additionally, the backpack and camera were essentially kind of laid out leaning against a guardrail on the side of a busy road. So investigators believe that the items may have been placed there to draw attention away from the forest where they would later be found.
I mean, makes sense, and that's smart.
And like I just said, the cases of Deborah and James's murders and Caroline and Joanne's murders were connected at this point, mainly because they, all of the, or several of the victims had signs of torture.
Okay.
So at this point, a task force was set up by the New South Wales Police. In October 1993, Task Force AIR was created. And just a little, like, tiny little fun fact, little moment of levity here, sort of, I guess. This was actually meant to be Task Force AIR, E-Y-R-E, named after a salt lake in the center of Australia, because the police department always named task forces after geographical places.
Okay.
But the media kept misspelling it as AIR, A-I-R. So they quickly changed the official name to be Task Force AIR, A-I-R.
Okay. They're like, we'll just go with it. Yeah.
Yeah, like, may as well if they're going to keep getting it wrong.
Yeah.
But less than a month after this task force was created, another body was found.
Jeez.
So as part of the task force, there was a police sweep going on throughout the entire Belongalo Forest, because after the first discovery, they had said, there's no more bodies. This time, they were going to be confident that there were no more bodies when they made that statement. And they were literally on the last gridded section of the search when they came across
another body.
Yep. So just first one? They found.
Okay.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
So first they found a pair of pink jeans. Mm. And then they found some blue and yellow rope. They also found an empty 22 caliber bullet pack. As they kept going deeper into this area, they found empty drink cans riddled with bullet holes, indicating target practice. Mm-hmm. They also found random things like wire, cartridge cases, and empty bottles. Then a bone was found, and shortly, the skeletal remains of yet another victim was discovered. This victim was also buried in a shallow grave, but unlike the other discoveries, she was alone. She had been stabbed 8 times. 2 of the wounds were so deep that they would have severed her spine, and others would have punctured her heart and lungs. A purple headband found on the body, along with clothing found right around the body, helped authorities identify this victim as missing German backpacker Simone Schmidl. 20-year-old Simone had been camping around Australia when, on January 20th, 1991, she was leaving Sydney to meet her mother, who was flying in from Germany to meet Simone in Melbourne and join her on her camping trip. Mm. Now, some sources say that basically her mom didn't realize how big Australia was, so chose to fly into Melbourne, didn't realize that Simone was in Sydney, which was like a significant distance away. Yeah. But Simone realized that too late before she could get her mom to change the flight.
Right.
And so she had to make her way to Melbourne. So she was like, I'm just going to, you know, hitchhike there. And Simone was a confident and seasoned traveler, and no one really worried about her. Her friends and family, who called her Simi, said that she was used to doing this type of thing. Simone was last seen at a train station preparing to leave for Western Sydney, where she would be hitchhiking to Melbourne. And she was never seen again.
Ugh, so heartbreaking, because her mom was like right there.
I know. She was going to meet her mom. Like,
oh. The guilt. I can only imagine.
While the skeletal remains were identified as Simone, though, the pink jeans found near her body did not belong to her. In fact, it was known to the task force that those belonged to another missing backpacker, a woman named Anja Habschied. 20-year-old Anja and her partner, 21-year-old Gabor, and I know I'm going to butcher this last name. It's a German last name. Neugbauer. I probably butchered that, but I'm doing my best. Gabor. They had been visiting from Germany to backpack around Australia. On December 26, 1991, Anja and Gabor left the Backpackers Inn at King's Cross in Sydney to hitchhike to Adelaide and Darwin. And checking out of the hotel was the last time they were ever seen.
Ugh.
On November 4th, 1993, after 3 days of searching the area around where Simone's body was found, along with Anja's pink pants, two more bodies were discovered in shallow graves.
Oh my God.
They were identified as Anja and Gabor pretty quickly, and they had been buried about 50 meters or 160 feet apart. Gabor had been shot in the head 6 times, while Anja had been decapitated.
Stop. No, my God. Like, purposely?
Yeah. It was determined that a sharp instrument like a machete or sword killed Anja. Mm-hmm. And the angle of the cut indicated that she had been in a kneeling position with her head down.
Oh, my God.
When she was decapitated.
Ugh.
And her skull has still never been found.
No. Oh, my God. It's going to make me cry. Oh, my God.
I know.
Why? Why are people so evil?
That's literally it. He is just so sinister and evil.
And I wonder, too, like, what is his reasoning for burying them so far apart from one another? Like, the people that were together.
I know. I don't know. Maybe to just separate them, and because he would like
added level of
sinister.
Evil. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it seemed like in a lot of the cases, he made one watch the other be killed. So I feel like he was trying to just be like evil in that sense of like, you guys don't get to be together.
Yeah.
Gabor had been subdued with a gag and knot tied across his mouth. And he had also been strangled, and his jaw was fractured in several places, indicating that he had been beaten just like Deborah.
Wow.
At Gabor and Anja's crime scene, interestingly, there were over 90 fired bullet casings. And it was determined that the same gun that killed Joanne Walters was fired at this scene.
So they connect again.
So they connected them.
Yeah.
So with all of these backpackers and hitchhikers going missing in New South Wales and the discovery of all of these bodies, Task Force Air determined that there was a serial killer in their area.
Yeah.
On November 5th, after Simone, Anja, and Gabor's bodies were found, the New South Wales government increased the reward money for any information leading to the killer from $100,000 to $500,000.
Wow.
The series of murders were taking over the news media, who nicknamed the killings the Backpack Murders. Investigators developed a profile of the killer at this point. They determined that the man likely led an ordinary life, that he would be intelligent and social and likely very fit. He was believed to be in his 40s and possibly married or in a stable relationship. He likely lived in the area that Belongalo was in the Southern Highlands. His victims were young travelers, both men and women, most who were hitchhiking from the Sydney area to the Melbourne area. Of course, this profile led to many new leads, and investigators checked out every single one, at one point having over 2,000 persons of interest.
Damn. That's great. Right? That's a lot of people to interview and check out. But that's a really great, excuse me, a really great profile. I mean, they
got they had a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Right on the head.
And the investigators were able to use this new link analysis technology to shorten their list of suspects. So basically, this allowed them to link credible tips and suspects to find commonalities. And this narrowed their list of suspects, because remember, there's a difference between persons of interest and suspects. Persons of interest are people who just have knowledge about the crime, and then suspects are like people who are suspected of doing the crime. Right. So their list of suspects was 230, but with this technology, they were able to narrow their list down to 32 people.
Wow.
Which still seems like a lot, but with not a lot of other evidence and the initial giant list, this is, you know, pretty good.
To go from 2,000 to 30. Yeah. That's pretty amazing. I wonder if they still use that technology and how accurate it is.
Honestly, it's probably just gotten better and better.
Yeah.
At one point, investigators theorized that there may have been several killers working together. And this mainly came from the fact that most of the victims had been attacked in pairs. Because they were saying, how could these people have been subdued by one person?
And I always say that too, because I'm just like, how, like, especially a man and a woman, because of the fact that, you know, you would think that a man could overpower another man. But when you're being threatened with a weapon, you're not going to put yourself at risk. You're not going to put your wife, your girlfriend, your best friend, whoever at risk. So it's easy to be controlled under those circumstances.
Yeah. And I wasn't going to include this, but I'll bring it up. But just know that it, like, hasn't been fully confirmed that this is exactly what happened. Mm-hmm. But in the case of James and Deborah, it's believed that basically Malat was, like, driving them off into this, you know, remote area. And they started to become worried and, like, started to say things. And James was like, hey, let's pull over and get out. And then kind of started shouting when he didn't listen. And it's believed that what happened was Malat then, like, basically hit the brakes really hard so that he would, like, fling forward because he was in the front seat, and then put a knife behind him so that when he fell back, he fell onto the knife, essentially, like, paralyzing him right away. And then that incapacitated him. And then he was able to threaten Deborah enough with the weapon, obviously seeing what he had just done to James. So again, this isn't, like, confirmed that that's exactly what happened, but that would kind of explain. And even if that's not exactly what happened, it definitely seems like Malat, I mean, clearly knew what he was doing and was able to somehow subdue the victims.
And do you know why they believe that in a lot of the cases he made one person watch? Was it just because of the manner in which they were murdered?
I think there's I think that's part of it. I think it's also kind of like what came out once Malat was arrested.
Okay.
So we'll get more into that.
Okay.
So investigators at one point did theorize that there were several killers working together. And part of it was because of there being two victims, but also because of, as we talked about, the different causes of death. Like, how could, or not how, but why? It wasn't as common for, one killer to have multiple MOs.
Yeah.
And then also how the victims had been buried separately. It was kind of believed, like, maybe there were two killers working together and then they kind of would each take one victim and do their thing.
Yeah. I could see how they came to that conclusion. I mean, it doesn't make any sense why those details would be that way if there wasn't two.
It doesn't.
There wasn't. So crazy.
There was just one. Yeah. So after these seven victims were discovered, things got very frenzied. Obviously, people in the area were terrified. There was a lot going on. There was a lot being reported in the media and not a lot of, like, information from the police of, like, this is exactly what's happening. And lots and lots and lots of tips were coming in. By November 13th, 1993, which is just 9 days after Anja and Gabor were found, a tip would come in that would change the entire course of the investigation. But that is where we're going to pick up in part two.
Awesome. Hopefully it changes the course in a positive direction.
It does. It does. And this was something that I wasn't aware of. This was exactly how he got caught. And when I was reading about it, I was like, holy shit, I can't believe that this man actually got caught. Like, he might have eventually, But the fact that he got caught when he did and how he did is...
It was meant to be.
It's pretty wild. So we got a lot more to go, you guys. There's him getting caught, arrested, trials, and so much discussion of potential other victims. Because while there are 7 confirmed victims, it is believed that he had many more.
Yeah. And I do want to touch one more time on the fact that he was able to subdue 2 victims at one time. I was thinking that he grew up on a farm, so he was used to like laborious work. Like, he was very strong, very smart. You know, he had all these things working in his favor. And of course, he used it for like bad. But, you know, you have to be strong to, you know, kill an animal and like manage a farm and all that. So he had like all those things benefiting him, unfortunately, in this.
Yeah.
In this
and way. He had practiced with hard labor too, because it wasn't just the farm and like him growing up, but then he was in the residential school and then he was sentenced to hard labor at one point. So like he had practiced doing maybe not exactly this, but things that could allow him to do this.
Yeah. I mean, imagine his strength. I mean, it's sickening, but oh my God. Imagine it.
So scary. He's so just freaky looking, because he doesn't really look like your like typical creepy serial killer. Like, he doesn't look like the...
Like a cowboy. Like,
yeah, he kind of does. He doesn't look like the like Ed Gein, you know...
He's got dead eyes, though. Disgusting. He definitely has dead eyes. He's got the dead eyes.
He does.
It's always a telltale sign.
Yeah. But that is all I have for you guys today. Thank you for 300 episodes. Stay tuned for the next episode. It will be part 2 of this case. And we will see you guys then. Until then, keep it human.
Bye.